Welcome to the introduction to a podcast recording of The Ego and His Own. This podcast is offered by unionofegoists.com, publishing the history of egoism in its first century. Thousands of pages of text, images, and recordings are available at no cost online, and a growing series of inexpensive and expensive rare works in reprint are also available. I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the Union of Egoists project is on Patreon. Those who are of their own free will would like to socialize their selfishness and support our site to allow podcasts like this to be recorded, I thank you. In this introductory episode to The Ego and His Own, I will be reading the preamble, which is the visceral 2.5 pages titled, All Things Are Nothing to Me. I will release it again as its own individual episode in a week after this full podcast is released. While this introductory episode contains some background information, future episodes will be devoted solely to reading the text of The Ego and His Own. Every other week, I will release a podcast containing a new section of The Ego and His Own, and I challenge you to listen with a critical ear. Did I mispronounce? Did I err? Read along with a complete free translation at theegoandhisown.com. Let me know how I can improve this recording by way of my website. When the podcast is complete, a corrected recording will be released for free as an audiobook on the public domain audiobook site, LibriVox.org. Now, Stirner's magnum opus, Der Einzig und sein Agentum, was originally published in 1845. While it saw some success and collected cutting criticism, Stirner and his work were all but forgotten as soon as 1848. Der Einzig was rediscovered and championed by the great efforts of anarchist and sex activist John Henry Mackay. Mackay spent a decade in the study of Der Einzig and diligently worked to return Stirner to print. Mackay also carried out extensive original research, including international travel, to write the only full biography of Stirner's life. The first known reference of substance to Stirner in the English language appeared in the American newspaper The Brooklyn Daily Eagle on November 8, 1849. Oddly, it states that Stirner was going to move to America. This short item also prints a pithy paraphrase of Stirner's philosophy. I've seen very few to rival it, even after 170 years. It is stated in one of the German journals that we are to possess as immigrants not only several of the superior officers of the Hungarian army and Garibaldi, but the famous Max Stirner, the great atheistic doctor of the North, who laughs at Proudhon's simplicity in his humanism as the sole religion, and sums up his own philosophy in this strain. Not merely is there no God, but humanity or mankind itself is a mendacious idol, and devotion to humanity a mere matter of priestcraft and monkhood. I am alone in the world. I exist alone. My enjoyment, my power, my liberty cannot be limited by any belief, by any rule, by any right foreign to my right. An 1898 issue of Clarence Schwartz's journal I announced the gathering of funds for the publication of an English language translation of Stirner's Einzig. Ragnar Redbeard, author of the egoist book Might is Right, was one of the first people to send money to fund the translation and publication. It is unclear when individualist anarchist bookseller Benjamin Tucker hired Stephen Byington to translate Stirner. By many accounts, the translation was assisted by James L. Walker, who wrote the introduction to the book. Walker, using the pseudonym Takak, wrote for the egoist journal The Ego and the Serpent, as did Tucker and Redbeard. Emma Heller Schum and George Schum also aided in the Byington translation of Stirner. A great deal of information on all these personalities and their works can be found at unionofegoist.com and in our journal, Der Geist. In 1906, in an issue of his journal Liberty, Benjamin R. Tucker announced, "The manuscript translation of Der Einsiegung seinen Gentem is now in the printer's hands, and I shall publish it next year, probably early in the spring. It is the greatest work of political philosophy and ethics ever written. On these subjects, it says the final and fundamental word. It banishes all the spooks forever." The task of printing Stirner's book, rendered in English as The Ego and His Own, was so important that Tucker temporarily suspended publication of Liberty. Tucker would later say that publishing Stirner was one of the most important things he ever did. Byington wrote to George Shum in 1907 after thanking him for his assistance on the project. In this letter, Byington records his philosophy of translation. "I agree, of course, to the general principles you lay down with regard to the art of translation. Yet I think these principles are misleading if emphasized without the balance of certain others which you neglect to mention. It is a translator's business not only to transfer the language of its original into the different idiom of a foreign language, and in so doing to preserve the original thought, but at the same time, and this is the highest and hardest point, to reproduce in the foreign language the style, the way of using language, which characterized the original. If the original was characterized by perfect smoothness and the avoidance of everything unusual, so should the translation be. If the original was characterized by a willingness to run into excessive faults for the sake of securing corresponding extreme merits, the translation should conform to this. Imagine translating the work of Charles Lamb or Rudyard Kipling into German or any other language in such a way that the result should be perfectly smooth German or other language, with nothing forced, no eccentric departure from ordinary idiom. Would not such a translation be a worthless caricature, sacrificing all that makes these writers what they are? So completely is this true that apparently the best results in translation, or at least in those branches of translation in which literary style counts for most, are attained by deliberately preserving more or less the foreignness as foreignness." Later in that same letter, Byington wrote, "Very few translations have merit to survive long. The few that do, that later renderings of the same books find it impossible to displace, and that take rank in literature alongside original works, are, generally, I believe, those that follow pretty closely to the style of the original, such as Urquhart's Rabelais or the English Bible." A fire swept through the offices of Benjamin Tucker's 4th Avenue property on Friday, January 19th, 1908. The entire remaining stock of Stirner's book, Tucker's own volume instead of a book, all the back issues of Liberty, the printing paraphernalia, and several important manuscripts were entirely consumed by the flames. By good fortune, the printing plates for The Ego and His Own had been shipped to the United Kingdom for printing by A.C. Fifield 4 months prior. Byington's English language translation stood alone for 110 years. In 2017, Wolfie Landstreicher's translation was published, and there are more than 24 editions of Byington's translation of The Ego and His Own, some with light editing by modern scholars. I will be reading from the actual 1907 edition. The first part of Einsieg is sometimes referred to as the preamble or prologue. It sets the tone and gives summary for the great work ahead. Since I am making commentary in this episode, I'll give you a little bit of information before I begin. To revisit the idea of the problem and possibilities of translation, I want to talk about one iconic sentence. The preamble is borrowed from the motto of Goethe's poem Vanitas. This prologue is the one section of the book that has seen multiple translations into English. Because of its importance to the book and the multiple translations over a century, it is a fine illustration. The prologue was the first significant bit of Einsiedeln to appear in the language of the Anglosphere when publisher E.H. Fulton included a translation of it by one H.J. Schirmer in an 1897 issue of the journal The Age of Thought. It was there that the title was rendered, "I've Based My Cause Upon Nothing." Byington's 1907 translation is, of course, "All Things Are Nothing to Me." In John Carroll's Roots of the Right edition of The Ego and His Own, published in 1961, we read it as, "I have founded my affair on nothing." A 1989 translation by Malcolm Green that was published in the Atlas Press book Black Letters Unleashed, 300 Years of Enthused Writing in German, Green renders the book title, "I've Based My Affairs on Nothing." Now, there is a translation of Goethe's poem by William Fligeir, who was a Swede who moved to Japan and became a Buddhist monk, who then turned egoist. He was a regular contributor to Sidney E. Parker's journals and a correspondent with him over many decades. Fligeir rendered the line the more poetic, "My thoughts and aughts are nothing fixed." And finally, in the recent Landstreicher translation, it is Englished as, "I have based my affair on nothing." I will note that the Malcolm Green and William Fligeir translations are available both in Der Geist, Issue 2. Without further ado, I present to you the beginning of the journey. The Ego and His Own by Max Stirner. Translated by Stephen T. Byington. Preamble. All things are nothing to me. What is not supposed to be my concern? First and foremost, the good cause. Then God's cause. The cause of mankind, of truth, of freedom, of humanity, of justice. Further, the cause of my people, my prince, my fatherland. Finally, even the cause of mind and a thousand other causes. Only my cause is never to be my concern. Shame on the egoist who thinks only of himself. Let us look and see, then, how they manage their concerns. They for whose cause we are to labor, devote ourselves, and grow enthusiastic. You have much profound information to give about God, and have for thousands of years searched the depths of the Godhead and looked into his heart, so that you can doubtless tell us how God himself attends to God's cause, which we are called to serve. And you do not conceal the Lord's doings either. Now, what is his cause? Has he, as is demanded of us, made an alien cause, the cause of truth or love, his own? You are shocked by this misunderstanding, and you instruct us that God's cause is indeed the cause of truth and love, but that this cause cannot be called alien to him, because God is himself truth and love. You are shocked by the assumption that God could be like us poor worms in furthering an alien cause as his own. Should God take up the cause of truth if he were not himself truth? He cares only for his cause, but because he is all in all, therefore all is his cause. But we are not all in all, and our cause is altogether little and contemptible. Therefore we must serve a higher cause. Now it is clear, God cares only for what is his, busies himself only with himself, thinks only of himself, and has only himself before his eyes. Woe to all that is not well-pleasing to him! He serves no higher person, and satisfies only himself. His cause is a purely egoistic cause. How is it with mankind, whose cause we are to make our own? Is its cause that of another? And does mankind serve a higher cause? No. Mankind looks only at itself. Mankind will promote the interests of mankind only. Mankind is its own cause. That it may develop, it causes nations and individuals to wear themselves out in its service. And when they have accomplished what mankind needs, it throws them on the dung heap of history in gratitude. Is not mankind's cause a purely egoistic cause? I have no need to take up each thing that wants to throw its claws on us and show that it is occupied only with itself, not with us, only with its good, not with ours. Look at the rest for yourselves. Do truth, freedom, humanity, justice desire anything else than that you grow enthusiastic and serve them? They all have an admirable time of it when they receive zealous homage. Just observe the nation that is defended by devoted patriots. The patriots fall in bloody battle or in the fight with hunger and want. What does the nation care for that? By the manure of their corpses, the nation comes to its bloom. The individuals have died for the great cause of the nation, and the nation sends some words of thanks after them and has the profit of it. I call that a paying kind of egoism. But only look at the Sultan who cares so lovingly for his people. Is he not pure unselfishness itself? And does he not hourly sacrifice himself for his people? Oh, yes, for his people. Just try it. Show yourself not as his, but as your own. For breaking away from his egoism, you will take a trip to jail. The Sultan has set his cause on nothing but himself. He is to himself all in all. He is to himself the only one, and tolerates nobody who would dare not be one of his people. And will you not learn by these brilliant examples that the egoist gets on best? I, for my part, take a lesson from them and propose, instead of further unselfishly serving those great egoists, rather to be the egoist myself. God and mankind have concerned themselves for nothing but themselves. Let me then likewise concern myself for myself, who am equally with God, the nothing of all others, who am my all, who am the only one. If God, if mankind, as you affirm, have substance enough in themselves to be all in all to themselves, then I feel that I shall still less lack that, and that I shall have no complaint to make of my emptiness. I am nothing in the sense of emptiness, but I am the creative nothing, the nothing out of which I myself, as creator, create everything. Away, then, with every concern that is not altogether my concern. You think at least the good cause must be my concern? What's good? What's bad? Why, I myself am my concern, and I am neither good nor bad. Neither has meaning for me. The divine is God's concern, the human's, man's. My concern is neither the divine nor the human, not the true, good, just, free, etc., but solely what is mine. And it is not a general one, but it is unique, as I am unique. Nothing is more to me than myself.